Livingston.
That's a good bill. Thank you.
Sir?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Michael Livingston. I'm a senior assistant attorney general with the Department of Justice Appellate Division. 2355, very simply, amends a current provision of the Oregon Delinquency Code to make it clear that juveniles adjudicated delinquent can move to set aside their adjudications of delinquency on the same grounds and subject to the same limitations as an adult could set aside a criminal conviction under the Post-Conviction Relief Act. The proposal comes from a specific problem, which is under current law, the juvenile court under 419C610 can set aside or modify any order made by it. That general language, at least to me, would appear to authorize the court to do exactly what we're proposing here. However, there's some confusion about that in the appellate courts, and there are a couple of cases now before the Court of Appeals that are struggling with that. And the question comes down in those cases to whether the juvenile was afforded adequate counsel. And the juvenile in those cases on appeal now is raising that issue on direct appeal from the adjudication. The problem, of course, with that is the same is the reason we have post-conviction relief in criminal cases, and that is there's no record on the issue of inadequate counsel. And just as in an adult post-conviction case, the criminal has to proceed and follow through with his direct appeal from the conviction before he or she can then go back to the trial court and move to set aside a conviction on constitutional grounds, those same limitations would apply here. The written testimony that I've submitted outlines, I think, in these terms what the bill does. And let me say this, too, that even without a statute, under the Due Process Clause of the Federal Constitution, and probably under Article 1, Section 21 of the Oregon Constitution, there would have to be some provision for juveniles to be able to do this. And the reason for that is this, that under the sentencing guidelines in Oregon now, a certain juvenile delinquency adjudications can be counted in an adult criminal's criminal history score. And so for that reason, if not just for basic fairness, there should be a procedure for juvenile delinquents to set aside these adjudications. What this does, as I said before, is bring those procedures in line with what's currently applicable in adult criminal convictions. And that's all I have to say today, and I'd be happy to respond to any questions.
Any questions? All right, since there are any questions, I appreciate your written
thank you
testimony. We'll review that and make sure we understand what you're doing clearly. Kathy Osborne, you're going to come up here and share with us too, aren't you?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Kathy Osborne, Senior Attorney for Juvenile Rights Project. I don't have much to add from Mr. Livingston's testimony, except to point out that I often get calls, or not often, but I sometimes get calls from defense attorneys around the state wondering what the process is to do a post-adjudication relief. The theories that have been put forward to me is not only the direct appeal that Mr. Livingston mentioned, but to do a straight mandamus or habeas corpus to the Supreme Court. When I explain to the defense attorneys that the way to do it is through 419C610, they seem kind of incredulous that that's the way to do it, but that's the way that you have, as Mr. Livingston said, a record which then the appellate courts can look at to determine, and also the trial judge is probably the best person to make a determination of whether counsel was inadequate or not. This doesn't change any rights, it just clarifies what the procedure is.
Can you give us a kind of a typical example of where this might occur or under what circumstance?
Well, I currently have one pending. I can certainly tell you about that case. In that case, a young man was represented on a very serious charge in juvenile court, and was the state had requested that this young man be waived to be prosecuted as an adult. During the, I did not represent this man in the trial phase. Let me make that clear. During the trial phase, in preparation for the waiver hearing, the attorney who was representing him had his investigator go out and speak to a witness who, although that witness was mentioned in a police report, was not on the list of the witnesses that the state intended to call. In preparation for the trial, after the waiver motion failed, in giving discovery, the defense attorney handed over a report written by the investigators as a result of the interview that they had with this witness, which was not favorable to the defense attorney's client and who the defense attorney was not going to call and the state was not going to call. And because of that, that was certainly malpractice on the defense attorney's point. When it was brought up to the trial judge that this happened, the trial judge told the state that they needed to settle this case to try to resolve the ineffective assistance of counsel claim, which they did. The young man then went to, who was denying that he was involved with this case at all, in this incident at all, went to McLaren, where he is facing disciplinary actions because he's unable to say that he was involved with this action, even though he admitted to it because of the deal that was done. It was a no contest plea, actually, but I mean, this is a very involved case, but essentially this young man's facing disciplinary actions because McLaren is not let, because OIA wants him to admit that he was involved, he wasn't involved, and he got there because of this, the defense attorney's being inadequate. The defense attorney obviously told the trial judge and the DAs that this mistake happened, and was very upfront about it once he discovered it, but it was probably the resolution that caused more of the problem than the defense attorney's.
So how does this bill facilitate?
Well, in that case, I was able to, I knew to file under 610. Once I filed under 610, I had to convince the trial judge that filing under 610 was actually the appropriate way to go. Even with the district attorneys agreeing that filing under 610 was the appropriate way to go, we actually had to have a hearing on whether filing under 610 was the appropriate way to go in front of the trial judge. And we're now in the process of the DA is filing a response brief too. Once now we've gone to that part. But what this would do is clarify for everybody. Like I said, I get calls from around the state.
You don't have to convince the judge that this is...
I don't have to convince the judge that this is okay. And I know from the calls that I get from defense attorneys around the state, they've had judges say, no, this is the improper way, that filing under 610 is not the proper way to do it, and send them to the direct appeal, which then the Court of Appeals says it's not the right way to do it. And you get people going back and forth with a youth who, if he or she has received ineffective assistance of counsel, is being unconstitutionally detained, probably.
Right. Mike, do you agree with that analysis, sir? Yes.
Senator, members of the committee, I think I can outline a little more briefly the case, one of the cases that's on appeal now. Juvenile was adjudicated delinquent for a sex offense, which would be a felony if he were an adult. On direct appeal from that, he's claiming in the Court of Appeals that the evidence is not sufficient to prove that, and he's also claiming that his attorney in the trial was inadequate because he didn't call certain witnesses. He's asking the Court of Appeals to hold the direct appeal issue on the sufficiency of the evidence, send it back to the juvenile court to make a record of this inadequate counsel claim. If this were an adult criminal case for the same crime, the adult could only challenge the sufficiency of the evidence, and only after that was held up on appeal then it would go back to the trial court for the post-adjudication. What this bill does would be to make those two processes parallel. In other words, so that the juvenile delinquent first would deal with the direct appeal, and then and only if that's affirmed does he get to go back to the juvenile court, because as a practical matter, unless the conviction or the adjudication is affirmed, the inadequacy of his counsel didn't do him any damage. And so that's really the practical effect on appeals, judicial economy, and to bring it in line with the same reasons we do it for adult criminals.
All right. Counsel has a question.
Mr. Lewis, I had one question on Section 3, Subsection A. This is only for a denial of a constitutional right in the proceedings, correct? So this is not the way that there would be, for example, an appeal of a search and seizure issue on the case. This is only for the proceedings itself, correct?
Senator Venice, counsel, that's correct. And one of the limitations here, which is the same as in adult post-conviction, is if it's something you could have raised but didn't on direct appeal, like a search and seizure issue, you can't raise it for this reason. So it would be only things like inadequate counsel, which you couldn't raise in the original proceeding, that you can raise here, or some other constitutional limitation that you couldn't bring on direct appeal.
However, this is Kathy Osborne. If the client, if the youth felt that a search and seizure motion to suppress should have been filed and the defense attorney did not file it, that could not be raised on a direct appeal and could only be raised on a post-adjudication. But the standard for that is the youth would not only have to show that the counsel was ineffective, but that it affected the case.
All right. Any other questions? Senator Beyer.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I guess the first question that comes to mind is at one point in time somebody thought it was a pretty good idea to do it the way they're doing it today, and why is that all of a sudden not a good way to do it, and this is the way to do it?
Senator Menace, Senator Beyer, there really has not been an established way of doing it, which is part of the problem. If the issue had come to me, for example, saying how do you do this, I would say look at 419C610. So that's question one, how do you do it? Question two is when do you do it? And actually, until we began to have these cases on appeal, an example of which I just gave, there really wasn't a problem because nobody was doing this. If they were moving to set it aside, it never came up on appeal. And Kathy, you may know more of this than I do, but I just don't think it was happening. In recent years, in the Oregon Supreme Court and in the Court of Appeals, they have allowed direct appeal in two kinds of cases, direct appeal challenges to adequacy of counsel. That's in a dependency case and a termination of parental rights case. The reason that the courts allow those on direct appeal is because it would cause too much delay for the dependent child to have to wait to go back to the trial court. And it's since those cases have been decided that we're seeing these challenges to adequacy of counsel on direct appeal in delinquency cases. And our position is, and I think it's reflected in the bill, that unlike termination cases and dependency cases, you don't have that dependent child waiting in the wings for the final decision. What you have here basically is a juvenile equivalent of an adult post-conviction case. And given that equivalence, we think, and the bill reflects, that the same limitations that apply in adult cases should apply in juvenile delinquent cases. So actually, in answer to your question, there was a void before. There wasn't any practice, and the only reason the void wasn't recognized or pointed out was because nobody was doing it. And since those inadequate counsel cases in the other two areas of juvenile law, that's when we see the problem, and that's the reason for the clarification.
And if I may, Chairman and Senator Beyer, I do know of a couple of cases where prior to the termination or the dependency cases saying that you could do inadequacy of counsel in direct appeal, or where juveniles did attack ineffective assistance of counsel through 419C610 or what was then 419610 or whatever it was before the juvenile code was revised. I do know that there were some cases. In both of those cases, the youth lost the ineffective assistance of counsel claim, and on both of the cases that I know of, decided not to appeal the loss of the ineffective assistance, so it never went up to the appellate court. so I do know that there were a couple of cases that were that it was done this way, but it never made it to the appellate courts because the loser of the that didn't want to appeal it.
Counsel has another.
Ms. Osborne, and this might be helpful, and I don't know, but currently under the statute, when you had mentioned you had a client who you wanted to do an appeal or do motion to set aside under 419C 610, you would go to the trial court to make that, and that's different from what the situation would be in the criminal courts.
Mr. Chair, Counsel Prince, yes, that is different from the criminal court, the adults in the criminal court. I don't practice in that area, but my understanding is that they file the case in the county where they might be incarcerated. So a lot of those cases actually get filed in Marion County since a large number of them are incarcerated in Marion County. We felt for juveniles that it would be a better procedure to go back to the trial court since the trial court actually had the ability to see the counsel in action and to make a decision about whether they wanted to set aside. That would give us the record where if the person who lost that motion wanted to appeal, there was then actually a record on what the inadequacy was, the alleged inadequacy was, what the effect that had on it, and what the court felt, the court actually making findings saying, I've seen this person practice in this case, and I don't think they were ineffective. I think that's why we didn't see appeals of those earlier cases, because that's a pretty strong statement and difficult for, I think, would probably be difficult for the appellate courts to actually overturn a trial court saying, I watched this attorney in action, and I didn't feel they were inadequate.
Further questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Close the public hearing on 2355. Open the public hearing on 2337. What do we got here, Captain? Is that, please? Okay, thank you. 2337 committee is where we're going to go up top. Mr. Nass, please. Jim Nass. Only one signed up.
Mr. Vice Chair, committee members, my name is Jim Nass. I serve as legal counsel for the appellate courts. House Bill 2337 deals with two subject matters. One is the it establishes the standards for waiving counsel in criminal cases. And the second main thing that it does is authorize courts to deny an otherwise valid waiver of counsel in two kinds of cases, death sentence cases and juvenile cases. Under the Sixth Amendment to the United States Constitution, a person charged with a crime has the right to the assistance of counsel. But likewise, under the Oregon Constitution, Article 1, Section 11, a person has the right in this state, quote, to be heard by himself in person and counsel, close quote. Lastly, ORS 9.320 permits any action or proceeding to be prosecuted or defended by a party in person or by counsel. Against that backdrop, in 1975, the United States Supreme Court, in a case called Feretta, held that a defendant in a criminal case has the right to waive counsel and to proceed to trial without a lawyer. Similarly, in Oregon, in a case called State versus Merrick, a 1992 case, the court held that in this state, also under our state Constitution, there is a right to proceed without counsel. Those were both trial court cases. Earlier in the year 2000, the United States Supreme Court, in a case called Martinez versus Court of Appeal, held that on appeal, a defendant in a criminal case does not have the right to waive counsel under the federal Constitution. So far, our own court has not had the opportunity to determine whether there is a right to waive counsel on appeal in a criminal case. So part of what this bill does is to set forth the standards that a defendant must show in order to make a knowing and voluntary waiver of counsel. To that extent, we think that the bill does nothing more than codify existing state and federal case law. But there are two exceptions found in this bill. Number one, as I mentioned, in death sentence cases, the courts would have the right to decline a proffered waiver of counsel. Also, in a juvenile court case, a juvenile would not have the right to waive counsel. You may be asking, why would we be advocating, why would a representative of the court be advocating for a bill that is possibly unconstitutional? With respect to death sentence cases, the reason is this. The death sentence is different from any other sanction. The cases in which the right to counsel has come up have always been non-death sentence cases. We think that the state has an interest, independent of the right of the person charged with the crime, to make sure that only persons who deserve the death sentence will get the death sentence. We also believe that it is more likely that a court, either trial or appellate, will commit error if a person is not represented by counsel, which possibly could lead to a person who does not deserve the death sentence receiving it. So it is for that reason that we are willing to advocate for a bill that ultimately may be struck down, because we believe that the policy is a sound one, and as yet no court that I am aware of has had the opportunity to address whether there is an absolute right to waive counsel in a death sentence case. With respect to juvenile cases, this was not actually something that the judicial department advocated for, but was added in the House. The thinking there, I think, was that juveniles lack the maturity to make a knowing and voluntary waiver of counsel. There are a couple of other minor things we think are somewhat minor things that the bill does, is it would explicitly authorize a custom of the courts in cases where a person waives counsel of appointing what we sometimes call standby counsel and what this bill calls a legal advisor, and the role of such a person would simply be available to consult with the defendant as the case went along. A second safeguard is that appellate courts would be required, where they denied a person the right to waive counsel, to give that person the opportunity to write his or her own brief and say anything that he or she wanted to. And lastly, House Bill 2837 makes it clear that the Court of Appeals has authority, independent of that of the trial court, to appoint counsel for appellate cases. Thank you, Mr. Vice Chair.
Thank you. Are there questions for Mr. Nass? Thank you very much, Jim.
I guess I should ask. I should mention that after the House approved its version of the bill, which had been fairly significantly changed from the original bill, we circulated the bill to a number of trial judges, and a number of trial judges have some reservations about the bill, and my own court is not certain that it wants to proceed with the bill as written, so we would ask that the committee perhaps not act on this bill today.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'd like to hear.
Public hearing closed. Open the public hearing on 2340. And Ann Christian from the Justice Department, if you come forward, please. You're the only one signed up on 2340.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Ann Christian. I'm here on behalf of the Judicial Department on House Bill 2340. House Bill 2340 was pre-session filed at the request of the Judicial Department, and specifically it was at the request of Presiding Judge Jack Madison in Lane County. The Department of Justice, so the Attorney General's Office, the Oregon District Attorneys Association, and the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association support this bill. The purpose of House Bill 2430 is simply to make clear what existing law is with respect to an unusual situation involving aggravated murder. That unusual situation is where a death sentence for one of two reasons is not an option for the jury to consider. The two situations in which a sentence of death is not available for a jury to impose on a person charged with aggravated murder. First is for a youth 18 or younger, but greater than 15 years of age, who can be charged as an adult with aggravated murder, but current Oregon law prohibits that 15 to 18-year-old from being sentenced to death. The second scenario would be where a district attorney, for any number of reasons, would decide not to pursue a sentence of death in an aggravated murder case. Currently, in the majority of cases, a jury faced with a charge of aggravated murder would have three options as far as sentencing a defendant. The first option would be a death sentence. The second option would be what people call true life. It's life without the possibility of parole. Some people call it civil death. And the third of the three options would be life imprisonment with the possibility of parole, but only after a mandatory minimum 30 years. In the two circumstances I've described, the 15 to 18-year-old, or in a case with an adult defendant where the district attorney decides not to pursue a death sentence, the current statute is, to say the least, confusing as far as what is it that the judge tells the jury to consider in deciding what sentence, one of two, true life or life with the possibility of parole, the jury should return. Judge Madison in Lane County has dealt with this confusion on more than one occasion. One such case, of course, was the Kinkle case, as far as what would the jury be instructed. And so Judge Madison brought this to our attention. We've worked with the Department of Justice and others to make sure that this bill is not changing what everyone agrees current law is. It does not make a substantive change, but rather it puts into one section in the aggravated murder sentencing law, ORS 163-150. It moves what were a number of cross-references to subsection 1 and subsection 1A, and puts the provisions specific to these two scenarios into one subsection. And what it makes clear is that the presumption in one of these cases where death is not an option, the presumption is the person will be sentenced to true life, to life in prison without the possibility of parole. And that presumption can only be overcome if 10 or more members of the jury find that there's sufficient mitigating evidence. So I would be happy to answer any questions. I do want to reiterate that this has been reviewed and is supported by the Department of Justice, ODAA, the District Attorneys, Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, and Presiding Judge Jack Madison would appreciate especially your consideration of this bill, because these cases are so rare that even in a busy county such as Lane County, the issue comes up maybe once every 5 years, and he indicates that he finds himself sitting down often with defense counsel who has not had this issue presented and DA who has not had this issue presented, and they spend sometimes hours trying to make sure that they're complying with the confusing laws that's currently written. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Ann. Now, questions for Ann Christensen, please, on this piece of legislation? Thank you. Close the public hearing on 2340, go to work session. I'd like to open the work session at 2340. I'd have to tell you, committee, no one else has signed up. We did have testimony from the previous witness that the District Attorney's Association, Criminal Defense Bar, were involved in this instruction, are in agreement with the bill, so I can't picture.
Mr. Chair?
Were you going to? Okay. Senator Beyer, please.
Move House Bill 2340 forward to due pass recommendation.
Okay, Senator Beyer moves 2340 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Are there any questions, comments, discussion this time on the motion before us? Mr. Chair, the bill we're going to work session on is 2340. You want to? We have a motion sent to the floor. We only have one witness, Ann Christensen, sign up and represents that the Criminal Defense Attorneys as well as the District Attorneys are for. So,
all right.
Okay.
Go for it.
Okay. Any objections to that motion? Okay. Bill goes to the floor and the hearing is closed on 2340. So it's back to you.
Really quickly here.
Yeah.
All right. We haven't done 2343.
I know. We haven't done 2343.
Okay. Then we'll do 2343. Public hearing.
I don't know what's going on here. I think it could be last night or something. Although,
Tim Travis, you're here looking out for my best interests, right?
Always, Senator. Always.
That's what I thought.
Timothy Travis, Oregon Judicial Department. It's 2 o'clock. This must be the Judiciary Committee, huh? I am here today on House Bill 2343, which, for the most part, is a product of a work group that I was not a part of. And that work group no member of that work group showed up on the House side to champion their work. But it's good work. And I would like to walk you through that first section. The second section is the product of my work and of Nancy Miller's work. And I will talk about that and champion that when we get there. But this is an amendment to the Child Abuse Reporting Act. Those of you who were here last session know that the Child Abuse Reporting Act received some moderate amount of attention in the last session. And as a result of that attention, a law was passed, that required that attorneys who are mandatory reporters of child abuse would be trained in their child abuse reporting obligation. I'm not going to go too far into the history of why that should be, but that is the law. I was contacted by the Oregon State Bar to go out and help train attorneys on their duty to report child abuse. And it was definitely an eye-opening experience for Oregon attorneys to be instructed as to what their obligations were and as to what the statute says and what it requires of them. And as a result of that, some amendments were made to the statute. In the first section, most of these are of the tenor of the amendment that's on line 15. There are certain crimes, or certain, there's child abuse must be reported by statute if you're a mandatory reporter. And I guess just to get an idea of what that means, if you look on page 3, section 2, line 5, that's the statute that says any public or private official having reasonable cause to believe that any child with whom the official comes into contact has suffered abuse, or that any person with whom the official comes into contact has abused a child, shall immediately report or cause a report to be made in the manner of ORS, whatever it is. The definition of child abuse is what Section 1 is. This is what you must report if you're a mandatory reporter. And the changes that were made here were on line 14 to subsection C, the definition. One of the definitions of abuse is rape of a child. And what was added by the work group was, or an attempt to rape a child. So it's the actual act, and then an attempt is added. The same is true on line 17, where it says sex abuse is defined as child abuse that has to be reported. And again, an attempt to commit that is now a mandatory reporting offense. The same is true on page 2, line 7. Buying or selling a person under the age of 18 is defined as child abuse. And again, they add attempting to buy or sell. Then the next change is on line 12. And what happened was that a very august member of this body a number of years ago caused the definition of abuse to be amended so that it said that abuse does not include reasonable discipline unless the discipline results in one of the conditions described above. In other words, you can reasonably discipline your child as long as what you do does not fall into the definition of child abuse. That change was made, as a matter of fact, as part of the best interest of the child legislation that you heard about yesterday when we were talking about the Troxel fix. This is expanded so that now injury caused by reasonable physical contact between children occurring during sports activities or play is not abuse that needs to be reported. Because one of the things we often forget is that child abuse is not necessarily committed only by adults. It can also be committed by children against other children if you look at the definition of child abuse under this act. So a foul in a basketball game is not child abuse. A flagrant foul, well, let's not go there. Because you got that word, that devil word, reasonable, in there. It was also thought necessary to define what a law enforcement agency means, and that amendment is in line 15 through 19. And again, I was not a part of this work group, and I have no idea why those four groups were named, but there they are. Finally, on line 29, it was thought by this work group necessary to amend the term peace officer to say a police officer or a reserve officer as defined by statute who's full or part-time and who's not a volunteer. And again, on line 41, it was deemed necessary to define exactly what a firefighter is for the purpose of this act. So that's section one. That's the work group's stuff. And as I say, I think as a person who has trained on this act and used this act for a number of years, I think those are all good amendments, and I think they're all necessary. Oh, by the way, over on page 3, line 4, state agency is defined because it says there's reference to state agency, and there's some ambiguity about what a state agency exactly is, but this statutory definition determines whether or not a particular organization is within the ambit of that term. Are there any questions about that particular so far before we get into the rat killing, so to speak? Okay.
I'm sorry. Questions?
I was wondered if there were questions on that part before we get into that.
Which part again?
The part, section one. Okay. Because section two is going to require a little more explaining and...
You got some splaining to do here.
Yeah, I was afraid you were going to say that. When I went out to train lawyers about this, I heard a lot of complaints about this statute, most of which you can't do anything about. terms like reasonable cause to believe that abuse has occurred, what does it mean to come into contact with someone. This statute doesn't seem to have any limitations on time or place. You know, what if this abuse occurred 30 years ago? You're talking to a 45-year-old client who says, you know, when I was 8 years old, my dad abused me. If you read this statute, you've got to report that. And there's no way to really deal with those kinds of problems, because as soon as you start to try to narrow the range of what has to be reported, then you start to exclude some things that should be reported. For example, if you have a 25-year-old person in your office who says, I was abused by my uncle, you might think, well, that was a long time ago, but that uncle might still be out there. That uncle still might be out there abusing children. So there really is a reason to make that report. So it's very difficult to do that. But one of the biggest complaints that lawyers had was that if you look at the last part of this duty, beginning on page 3, line 9, right in about the middle of the paragraph, it says, nothing contained in ORS 40225 to 40295, and that's the privileges section of the evidence code, shall affect the duty to report imposed by this section, except that a psychiatrist, psychologist, clergyman, or attorney shall not be required to report such information communicated by a person if the communication is privileged under the privileges section. What this means in English is that if my client, if I am an attorney representing a client on a burglary, and that client says to me, by the way, I beat the heck out of my kid the other night with a big orange stick, that is privileged information. I, as the attorney, cannot divulge that information by law. My client can expect confidentiality from me. That is a confidential communication. However, if I'm representing that client on the burglary and I read in the police report that his next door neighbor saw him come home the night of the burglary with a cellophane bag full of the neon cats that were stolen from the pet store, I have a duty as the attorney to go out and investigate and to interview that witness. And if that neighbor tells me, yeah, but you know what, you think you got trouble because your client steals cats from the pet store, wait till the cops finds out he beats the heck out of his kid with a big orange stick. That is not a confidential communication, because it did not come to me from my client. It is what is called a secret, because it came to me from a third party. Now, for any other purpose, I am ethically required to keep the secrets of my clients secret. For the purpose of this act, however, the way it is written, I am required to report my client for a secret. Now, why that's a problem for lawyers, aside from the fact that no lawyer likes to rat out his client, is that that lawyer has to, in that circumstance that I described, I have to resign now as his attorney, because I've given him up to the authorities. I call up, I say, he beats his kid with a big orange stick, goodbye, I withdraw as your attorney. The next attorney who gets the case is going to do exactly the same thing. The next attorney, he or she, is going to take that police report and going to go out and talk to that neighbor and learn that same information. And if no legal proceeding comes out of that information, that report of child abuse, then that attorney has to call up and report, and that attorney has to withdraw. So essentially, you get into a cycle. You can get into a cycle that starts to implicate someone's Sixth Amendment right to counsel. So what the lawyers across the state told me loud and clear was, we really want to be protected with our client's secret in this regard to the same extent that we are protected with our client's secret in any other kind of case. And so what this First Amendment, which is the dark language in lines 12 through 14, what that says is that in the instance of committing child abuse, an attorney does not have to report confidential communications, that is, communications from the client, nor secrets, which is information that the attorney learns in the course of representing the client. That's the first of the two amendments. The Second Amendment has to do with the fact, and that's the language that's in sub 2 of section 2, lines 15 through 20, This amendment is one that the judges really wanted, and practically everyone else who works in the system, because there is no exception in the current rule that allows you to not report stuff that's already known by the agency or by law enforcement. And here's an example. Kathy Osborne and I used to work in the same office. Hard to believe someone who would employ her would also employ me, but nonetheless, Kathy and I used to work in the same office. We would occasionally cover hearings for one another. She would have something to do, and I'd say, well, I'm free at 11 o'clock. I'll go cover that review hearing. She hands me the file of little Crystal Jones, who's been abused. I open up the file. I read the file. There's a report from SCF that says Crystal Jones has been abused. I can reasonably believe that Crystal Jones has been abused. Guess what? Under this law, I have to make a child abuse report because I read it in a file of an ongoing case. Okay. Now, the judge, later in the day when I walk into court and we start talking about Crystal Jones's case, the judge has to make a report under this law. I have to make a report. Every attorney in the room has to make a report under this law because of the way that it's drafted. So what this amendment says is that if you learn about this abuse in the course of the case, you don't have to report it if you reasonably believe that it's already known by the agency. Now, if I'm representing Crystal and I go out to her foster home, and her foster mother says, you know, she's in care because her father beat her up, but last night she told me that he also molested her. If I reasonably believe that, under this, I have to report that molestation because that's not information that the agency already has. That's new information. So those are the two amendments that we are proposing. The first is that information that an attorney learns in the course of representing a client has the same status for confidentiality as information that the attorney learns directly from the client. And second, that information that is already known to the agency doesn't have to be re-reported ad nauseum by everybody who's involved in the case. And let me say, by the way, that this stuff about reporting stuff ad nauseum over and over again, that's not happening today. Judges are not, and lawyers are not. Nobody is reporting this stuff over and over again. But the law says that that should be what's happening. No one wants that to be what's happening, so that's why this amendment is proposed. So if you have any questions, I would be pleased to try to deal with them now.
Senator Burdick.
Mr. Chairman, subsection 2 on line 15, do you think this is written clearly enough to make sure? I mean, could somebody come in and say, well, you know, this abuse was so intense and I knew that this child was under review by the Children's Services Division, and therefore I just assumed that they would have reported it or something like that. I mean, is this written narrowly enough to let people off the hook just on the basis of presumption rather than having actual knowledge that someone else had reported it?
Senator Burdick, it's certainly foreseeable that someone could say that. To violate your duty is a Class A violation of the law. So to be prosecuted for that Class A violation, the state would have to show that you did not reasonably believe that the information was already in the hands of the authorities. That's sort of the standard, is whether or not you could reasonably believe that the authorities knew that. So it would become a question of fact for a jury. I said, well, not for a jury with a Class A violation, but it would become a question of fact as to whether or not you knew that. The kicker for this, of course, is that, look, the 10,000-pound canary that's in the room that nobody talks about in this case is civil liability. That's the real question. This Class A violation is not what's going on here. What's going on here is, am I going to get sued by some victim because I did not report the victimization that victim underwent? And that has happened in Oregon where people who did not report abuse were sued, and there were successful settlements and real money was paid out, which is how the legal system gets, you know, the attention. So the reasonable belief would be probably in the end, if you're saying, well, I'm just going to not report it, I'm just going to say I had a reasonable belief, you can say that if you want to, but it may become a jury question at some point in the future.
Yes.
Would it make sense to make that then an affirmative defense rather than just setting it?
In other words, make it an affirmative defense rather than making it an element of the crime? Well, I don't know that that would make more sense or not. I don't.
Because then people, you know, would have to really go through the process of, if I don't report this, you know, I'm subject to this violation. But, you know, if I had to defend, I mean, it's just kind of a different, to me that seems a little bit more, just a bit higher a bar for people to look at.
Yes, Senator Minnis, Senator Burdick, it is a higher bar. And what happens is, of course, that it gets determined, I think, in the course of the litigation, the way that an affirmative defense works is you get charged and then you raise the affirmative defense so that it's your burden to prove that you reasonably believed, rather than the state's burden to prove that you didn't reasonably believe. It just makes it harder on the individual, you know, at crunch time. If that's the committee's pleasure, but the way that we chose to write it was to make it an element of the offense. What do you got? Affirmative defense doesn't help in a civil case. Well,
I guess it's a bad idea.
Thank you very much, Ms. Osborne. Now you see why the same firm that would, I'm very lucky that they employed me. But for the purposes of what's stated here in terms of the Class A violation, the affirmative defenses would work.
I've always thought this should be a misdemeanor, or at least a Class A misdemeanor. It was a few years back, and that changed the violation. What's the logic or rationale behind deleting the language with due regard to the culture of the child?
Oh, I skipped over that, didn't I?
Yes, you did.
As I say, Senator Minnis, as I say, I was not a part of the work group that actually made that omission, but I know that that is something that people have expressed concern about for a number of years because, first of all, nobody knows exactly what that means, and second of all, there's some cultural stuff that's pretty ugly out there in terms of the way that children are treated in other cultures. I suppose female genital mutilation might fall into that category. But I don't know why they took it out, but that's what some of the discussion's been over the years.
Okay. Who actually wrote this?
Who actually wrote?
Yeah, whose bill is this? Is interim judiciary?
Senator Minnis, I don't even know for sure the people, the identity of the people who were involved in writing this first part. I care about the second part. Senator Harper, I care about the second part. The first part's good stuff, and it's fine, but the second part is what Nancy and I wrote, and this is the vehicle we found to use. And I don't know why somebody left their baby on the doorstep, but there it was.
Okay, we do have some handwritten testimony here from Detective Sergeant Bob Wallacher, Multnomah County Child Abuse Team, who says, quote, "It is a knee-jerk reaction to a case last year in which an attorney failed to report child abuse and was successfully sued."
Senator Minnis, I would agree with that, except that if this bill had been law, that attorney still would have been successfully sued, because the facts of that case were not one in which an attorney failed to divulge a secret, nor were the facts of that case one in which an attorney did not report something from within the system. That was a domestic relations case, from what I know of the situation. It turned on entirely different facts.
You know where that case is out of?
I believe it was out of Marion County. I can find out where it was out of. It did not go to litigation. The PLF paid off.
Well, they did?
Yes. Okay. There were two such cases.
All right. Thank you. Okay, any other questions? None? No, no, thank you, Tim. Anybody else? Kathy Osborne, do you want to chat on this? You kind of have been doing this with this ventriloquist thing.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Kathy Osborne, Senior Attorney for Juvenile Rights Project. Juvenile Rights Project did not get involved last session in the child abuse reporting argument that was going on, although we did feel that the bill that came out was a good bill. I think that this bill makes it better. Mr. Travis talked about the judges not reporting, you know, that we all have an obligation to report to situations that come up is, you know, an SCF worker could call me, tell me about that my client had just acknowledged that more abuse had taken place. I'd have to hang up the phone and call SCF back, a different person at SCF back, to make the report. In our office, we are told to err on the side of over-reporting rather than under-reporting because obviously we're concerned about child abuse and making sure that child abuse is reported, but it is rather frustrating when I have a lot of stuff to do to have to call the hotline when one of the first questions they ask me is, does SCF know about this? And I have to say, well, yes, the SCF worker called me and told me about this, and they won't even take a report. Now, I'm obligated to report. SCF won't even write down the report or write down that I called, so I have no way to show that I did call other than a log note in my file that I called. So that's kind of the frustration that I think that part takes care of. I think the first section, it makes it clearer exactly what abuse needs to be reported. You get a lot of questions about when I'm doing trainings on this, and I did this training for the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. You know, the question becomes, I'm standing in the grocery store line, and a mom, you know, has the crying child standing there who, you know, is screaming on top of their lungs, and they give them a little pat on the behind. Is that something I need to report? I think it's probably harder than the kid deserves, but, you know, that something like that. This makes it, I think, clearer exactly what needs to be reported, and that makes it easier for everybody to make sure that they comply with it and actual child abuse does get reported. As for the section on the secrets, I would note that what the wording is that the attorney is not required to make a report. If the attorney wants to make the report because the attorney feels morally obligated to report and disclose this client's secret, the attorney has the ability to do this. This gives a situation, however, as Mr. Travis said, when you're representing somebody on something where the circle is just going to continue, to be able to say, I'm going to continue to represent this person because that's not the issue here, and maybe encourage the neighbor to report it or whatever. But the attorney is not required to, but also can make the report along with confidential information. The attorneys can make that report if they want to. It doesn't preclude them from doing it. It just says if they do it and follow their ethical rules put forward by the Oregon State Bar, that they aren't going to be subject to discipline, because that's certainly the conundrum that lawyers can get into, is my ethical rules say I can't report it, this law says I have to. If I violate the ethical rules, I can get disbarred. If I report and if I don't report and should have reported, I can get disbarred. I need to figure out which way to do it, because sometimes it seems that either way you turn, you're looking at a possible disbarment.
Okay. Any other questions? Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Close the public hearing. I'm personally not sure how I feel about this particular bill. Okay. Let's do is Steve Marks is not in the room.
Thank you.
Who's they?
I don't know.
We're going to leave it up to Diane to do this?
They can do it.
Let's do a work session on Senate Bill 365. This is that bill we had a long time ago dealing with the department owning property. Oh, yes. We have dash two amendments. Diane?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Diane Middle, Director of Department of Public Safety Standards and Training. And as you indicated, this is a bill that we did have testimony on quite some time ago. There was some concern at the time by the committee that perhaps this should reflect back to ORS Chapter 270 as to how the department could handle that acquisition, in other words, being obliged to follow by the rules of Department of Administrative Services. The other amendment that we were seeking at that time was allow the agency to be able to handle infrastructure costs through the certificates of participation process. This went to Legislative Council, and I believe you received a letter back from Legislative Council on March 14th. And in the Dash 1 amendments, they included the language that relates back to Department of Administrative Services, but recommended against that because it would have a tendency to imply that other state agencies might not have to follow those rules since it didn't expressly say so for the rest of them. So the Dash 2 amendments have it without that language. And, of course, the department recognizes that it, too, like all other state agencies, must follow the rules of Department of Administrative Services, and that appears in Section 2 of the Dash 2. And on the second page of the Dash 2 amendments at line 8, it indicates that the department would be able to fund or finance infrastructure components through certificates of participation. And that's sort of all we did with it.
All righty then. Does everybody have the amendment?
The Dash 2.
The Dash 2 amendment, yes. Anything else you'd like to share?
We're just attempting to locate Mr. Marks for you.
Oh, okay. And we're assuming that Mr. Nickelberry over in DAS is still working on trying to identify how much property the state actually owns.
Actually, he's not. He's now with Department of Human Services, I believe. But Mr.
Got so frustrated he quit.
we did him in that.
But actually, Mr. Dave. Mr. Dave White and also Bill Foster are here if you had any additional questions. And my understanding is they have provided some documentation on that to you.
How much property do we own?
Yeah, who's in charge on this one?
We ran the last guy out of here, so he has to be careful.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Bill Foster with the Department of Administrative Services, and with me is John Wales, who is basically taking over some of the responsibilities that Mr. Nickelberry previously had.
Now, where did Nickelberry go?
To the Department of Human Services.
Human Services.
Yes, quite recently.
All right.
In terms of the simple answer, and perhaps Mr. Wales can share a few of the statistics, the state has about 3 million acres. And we have some inventory data on that. And I don't know how far you would like to go into some of this, but...
I'm not going to go too far, but, I mean, the question was, do we know how much property we own? And the last time we had this discussion, we didn't. So do we know now, or are we still in search of knowing?
Did you... refer to any specific information?
No, you know how much property the state owns.
Oh, state owns roughly 3 million acres of land.
Roughly.
Property statewide.
Okay.
About 65% of it, about 2 million of that is owned by the Division of State Lands. About 22% of it is owned by the Department of Forestry. That would be roughly 658,000 acres. There are 18 agencies that own property in the state, but as you can tell or hear, the lion's share is owned predominantly by those two agencies. As far as actual number of parcels,
the Department of Transportation has the largest number of actual parcels. They're very small. Most of them are along highways throughout the state. But as far as total acreage, the Department of Division of State Lands and the Department of Forestry are the about roughly 88% of the state's property.
Senator Byrd.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So do you have a book or something now that tells us exactly what we own?
I'm sorry?
Do you have a book of some kind or something that tells us exactly what we own as a state and who owns it and how much there is and where it is?
The Department of Administrative Services has a database that keeps track of the property that the state owns, both for land and for facilities. Each agency, however, the information that's kept in that database is at a fairly broad level. Each agency that owns facilities and land has a much more detailed database that basically rolls into the DAS one. In fact, we are in the process of doing an upload into the DAS database so that there will be updated. We do that every few years.
I thought it was a yes or no question. So
okay. Well, you guys, thank you for doing some work.
Appreciate that.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, sir.
I move the dash 2 amendments to Senate Bill 365.
Senator Courtney moves the adoption of the dash 2 amendments to Senate Bill 365. Discussion? Senator Neskin.
I like the fact that they took the conveyance out of Section 2, so I'm pleased with it.
You're pleased. All right. Any other discussion? Any objections? Hearing none.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 365 as amended to the Senate floor with a do-pass recommendation.
Senator Courtney moves Senate Bill 365 as amended to the floor of the Senate with a do-pass recommendation. Discussion?
Probably
not. One objection, Senator Beyer. Any other objections? Hearing none. So ordered, and let's see. I guess I'll carry it. You guys, thank you very much. And at some point in the future, you probably should know how much property we own. Where is that? You guys, are you going to do something like that, like have a portfolio file, and you're going to eventually get that wired together so you know where all this stuff's at?
Yes, we do. It's in the process of being updated, but we can provide that information.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Duncan.
Some time ago, when I was chairing the government committee, this issue came up, and I think they came to us and gave us a full report on how they were out trying to really identify it all and codify it and put it all together. So I know it's a work in what?
Progress.
1984.
Yeah, when did you start the legislature? Okay. No. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Oh, that's right. It was the other stuff.
All righty then. Senate Bill 722, work session. Where's my staff?
I can tell you the acre and acres I have.
You'd think we would know. We're on 723.
Okay. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, Senate Bill 722 is here. Mr. Mann, why don't you just come up here in case there's any questions. This is the bill that we had regarding the Board of Investigators. We heard testimony on the Dash 1 amendments on April 25th, and a couple questions came up and a couple amendments were requested that I had LC draft. This bill is the same as the Dash 1 amendments, but for three differences, and I would like...
Which amendment are you looking at?
At the Dash 2.
Two or three, okay.
I'm sorry, the Dash 2.
Dash 2.
And I'll explain also why we have two amendments.
Right.
On the Dash 2 amendments, the first change is on page 9. You'll recall that I brought up in the hearing that I wanted to know if the board wanted to make it mandatory that they try to rehabilitate, educate, or mentor a person before firing them or suspending them or revoking their license at a board as an investigator. They did not. So on page 9, line 26,
I just changed, asked them to change, the board shall attempt to provide to the board may attempt to provide. So that's the first change.
And what line is that on? Is that page
that is on
line?
Page 9, line 26. The board may attempt to provide.
Okay.
On page 10, there were two issues. One, I think it was unclear whether, in regards to lines 13 through 19, this deals with the board of the Oregon Board of Investigators. Thank you.
Okay.
Members of the board, it's my understanding that they wanted your call on line 14. Two members must be members of the Oregon State Bar. I think they wanted two attorney members. And the other issue was line 16, it says the governor shall consider a list, so that it does not bind the governor, but he shall look at that list. And then the last amendment,
that again?
That's on page 10, line 16, where it says the governor shall consider a list of candidates. We didn't want to get into a situation where we were doing something we couldn't by binding the governor to look only at the list that was provided. And lastly, on page 19, you recall we had testimony from a client of an investigator who said that he wanted to make sure that there still was a requirement for written contracts. Section 25 in the -1 amendments had repealed that requirement, and we changed it so it does not repeal that. Still requires a written contract, and only 703.420 is repealed under Section 27 now, which is on page 20. That's the part that repeals the definition of operatives and repeals that. So I think those were all the three amendments that the committee had requested. And Mr. Mann, I don't know Mr. Mann is here if you have any other questions.
All right. And why do we have -3s? What are the
-3s? I was unclear on whether they wanted it to read as far as the members of the board, whether they want it to be Oregon State Bar lawyers or members of the general public. So if you look on page 10 of the -3s, line 14, I had that one say must be representative of the general public because I was unclear on which they wanted. Mr. Mann informed me that they wanted it to say members of the Oregon State Bar so they could get some legal advice.
All right. This thing needs to go to Ways and Means. It goes anyway.
Chair, do you want to move the -2 amendments?
Yes, sir.
Mr. Chair, I move the -2 amendments of Senate Bill 722.
All right. Senator Courtney moves the adoption of the -2 amendments to Senate Bill 722. Discussion. Any objections?
Mr. Chair, I would like to move Senate Bill 722 to Ways and Means.
Senator Courtney.
As amended, I'm sorry. Yes.
Thank you. Senator Courtney moves. Senate Bill 722 is amended by this committee to the Committee on Ways and Means. Discussion.
Yes, fiscal
on this. Mr. Chair and Senator Harper, I didn't get a fiscal on the -2 amendments. Is that required? Yeah. We did not get one yet.
Yeah. In essence, the budget for this organization is still in the Public Safety Subcommittee. They've got one piece of legislation that we sent down previously dealing with investigators who work for attorneys. And didn't we have an amendment to that?
Yeah.
Somewhere?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, regarding the investigators for attorneys, that was the one that I think Ms. Swenson had brought. There was some pending litigation, and we did make an amendment to that.
406. Yeah, Senate Bill 406. Now, did we actually make that amendment, or is it waiting to be adopted? Angry, come help us, please.
Yes.
Mr. Chair, the committee did amend the bill in committee. However, I had requested additional amendments, which I presented to yourself.
Okay, so I have so amendments have somewhere.
Yes, I can.
What do those amendments do? Just remind me, if you will.
The bill as amended, as it passed out of committee, excluded from coverage under the Investigator Act any person employed by an attorney. And the amendment that we requested that the chair review would have exempted investigators who work full-time for one employer, but not any investigator who works for an attorney, because basically that would involve all of the investigators.
All right, and that's just a clarifying amendment, attorney.
It is.
Okay. So what I need to do is get that amendment down to Ways and Means with a letter indicating that it's okay to amend down there. So, okay?
Thank you.
So we will do that. And I think the subcommittee chairman of Ways and Means is waiting to look at this as a package. Okay, any further discussion? If not, down to Ways and Means. 2348, public hearing. Oh, excuse me, work session.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2348 comes to you from the Joint Interim Judiciary Committee. It was here last week, and we got an amendment to the bill. The dash A4 amendments before you. The bill allows a person over whom the State Board of Parole and Post-Prison Supervision exercises its jurisdiction to seek judicial review of a final order of the board if A, the person is adversely affected by the order, and B, the person has exhausted administrative review before the board. Currently, Mr. Chairman, as a committee, you may remember we heard testimony that currently this process, someone who is in prison or under supervision of the State Board of Parole would file a writ of habeas corpus with the circuit court. If they lose before the circuit court, usually in Marion County, they then appeal to the Court of Appeals. This would make the process similar to administrative review process, where the person would take an appeal directly to the Court of Appeals, and then for the grounds, the process set forth here. Your A4 amendments, if I could go through them, they go over to page 2 of the A and Gross Bill, line 32. It kindly says, submit to the court the written record of the proceeds. That written would be removed, and then after proceeding before the board would be removed. And then going down to line 34 on page
2.
On page 34, line 2, again, taking out written, and then after record, removing the rest of the line, and then going down to 35. So it would read, deliver a copy of the record to the petitioner. Then going down to line 36, line 40, it would take out the sentence beginning with the petitioner. And then going over to the page 3, it would remove within 30 days after date of the court's order. Is everyone following me so far?
Mm-hmm.
And then deleting lines 6 through 9. So remove the last paragraph there. And then going over to page 4 at the bottom, it would remove cases initially brought in the bold language in line 5, and it would add cases seeking judicial review under ORS 144.335 when the public defender cannot provide representation due to conflict of interest. Jim Nass is here, as is David Groom and Phil Schradel, and I understand that they've all looked at these amendments, and Ann Christian has looked at them too, and they're all in agreement on the amendments. They're basically technical, and they do what they intended them to do.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Courtney.
I move the A4 amendments to House Bill 2348. I think that's how I say it.
Yeah.
All right. Senator Courtney moves the adoption of the A4 amendments to House Bill 2348. Discussion? Any objections?
Mr. Chair.
Committee on Ways and Means.
Oh, it's just late. Okay, Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2348 as amended by this committee to Ways and Means.
Senator Courtney moves House Bill 2348 as amended to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Where's
the discussion? Any objections? Hearing none. Public hearing, House Bill 2351.
I don't think anyone signed up for this one.
Ingrid, would you remind me to get that letter down there just in case I forget? Thank you very much.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, House Bill 2351, as I recall, is one of the bills that Senator Kate Brown, we had a very brief public hearing on. Is that, no? There's no one signed up for this bill, correct? Mr. Nass, are you here?
Colorable bill.
Colorable one.
I love that word.
Famous legal phrase, folks, colorable.
Would someone explain that word to us?
Yeah, first and lawyer.
This is big time. When you say colorable, you have arrived as an attorney.
Well, this will save money. This is $125,000.
Oh, this is the one I went round and round and round on.
Right, and I use this
one. Okay.
All right. The motion that I'd like to have that money used for some of my check address.
Public affairs?
Give us a little snippet again. Remind us what this bill does. This is the one where I got all wrapped up in whether the attorney was doing a good job or not doing a good job.
Mr. Chair, my name is Jim Nass. I serve as legal counsel for the appellate courts. The main purpose of this bill is to reduce the workload of the state public defender, the courts, and the attorney general's office by requiring a showing that an appeal presents a culpable claim of error for three groups of defendants: those who have pled guilty, those who have pled no contest, or a probation revocation case, and I guess actually there's a fourth one, if the defendant has been resentenced pursuant to a remand from the appellate court. I kind of heard a question of what constitutes a culpable claim of error. In my view, a culpable claim of error is an error that a lawyer can make with a straight face that, if not rebutted by the other side, is an error that the court could consider as grounds for modification or reversal of the judgment. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right.
Do I do something with this one?
Well, I'm trying to figure this. I've got some possible amendments for this bill. Would you guys like to have some amendments to help?
No, that was, Mr. Chair, that was House Bill 2348 that...
I'm asking you if you would like to, come up with some amendments to help the bill do some better things in the criminal justice system.
whatever the chair would like.
Signal late in the session.
All right. And it's relating to criminal appellate procedure. Okay, we're going to close down the public hearing on this bill, and we'll bring back some amendments that will be a lively discussion. I know what's coming.
Did anyone watch the judge last night?
All right. What's that? Senate bill, work session, Senate bill 542.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, Senate Bill 542 is a bill that we heard some time ago, and it was a bill sponsored by Senator Starr and Senator Menace regarding runaway children. We heard testimony on this from a police officer from Chief Darrell Crandall from Banks, Oregon, and you have in front of you the -1 amendments to the bill. The -1 amendments do this. If you look at the bill, it currently is a Class C felony to aid and assist a child in running away from the child's home. One of the key parts of this is on line 6, the state of mind that the prosecutor would have to prove would be for the purpose of helping the child to run away from home. So this amendment changes that to an A misdemeanor and changes the, if you look at -1 amendments, lines 4 to 10 create exceptions so that this bill does not apply to a person who provides clothing or shelter to the child if a law enforcement agency or SCF has been notified. And does not apply if a person transported a child who has run away from a place of danger to a place of safety if they notify the law enforcement officers. And it does not apply to a child care agency listed in ORS 418-240. Those are the amendments that Senator Starr's office got to this bill.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash one amendment to Senate Bill 542.
Senator Cordy moves the adoption of the dash one amendments to Senate Bill 542.
Discussion. Objections. Hearing none, so. Well, Mr. Chair, I'm going to move the bill, but I don't want you to feel bad after I move it. No, I can't do that. Senator Duncan?
Okay. I move Senate Bill 542 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
All right. Senator Duncan moves Senate Bill 542 to the floor of the Senate. Due pass recommendation, and we will ask for a roll call vote.
No.
Aye.
He votes yes.
Senator Meyer.
No.
Senator Metzger.
Aye.
Chairman.
Oh, wait a minute. Courtney's no, then. Jeez.
Chair votes no. What's the tally?
One to
one aye. Vote.
Duncan.
Two. Two, three. Kill that one.
Come on. Somebody's supposed to be contrary. You voted yes.
Yeah, two yeses. You have, or three yeses and three noes.
Okay. 3-3. Motion failed. All right. Any other bills on the committee today?
That's it.
All right. Adjourned.